ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Before we get going, a word of warning. What you're about to hear has a bit of colourful language.
We're here.
I'm sitting in the car on the side of the road with my colleague and friend, Beck Trigger.
I don't want to, like, come in, you know, all guns blazing.
We're parked out the front of a small brick home in Perth South. There are old-fashioned CCTV cameras out front. Otherwise, it's pretty unremarkable. But just looking at it is filling me with dread. Inside is the last known person to see Ray and Jenny Kellett alive. And we're here to knock on his door to ask if he's willing to talk to us. But now that I'm faced with actually doing it...
I actually feel a bit sick being here. I feel really anxious.
I've chickened out.
I'm not going to knock with Beck. I have left Beck to go in on her own. That's not very nice of me, is it?
My name's Ash Davis, and in a small windowless office out the back of the ABC studios, Beck and I have been investigating what happened to Jenny and Ray Kellett. The Kelletts went missing in 2015 while on a trip to Western Australia's Midwest. Ray's death was later deemed a homicide. Jenny is believed dead. The Kelletts are kind of part of my big blended family. Jenny's three children are my step-siblings. 8 years after they were reported missing, charges have yet to be laid, and Beck and I want to find out why. In our last episode, we travelled 700 kilometres northeast of Perth to the place where Ray and Jenny were last seen alive, where my stepsister Britt and her partner Alex desperately searched for her mum's remains. And we met Army vet Rick, who's been using his experience to try and find any missed evidence.
I believe something is out there.
This week, we want to find out more about the last person to see Ray and Jenny Kellett alive, their mate, Graham Milne. He drove up and camped with the Kelletts before they disappeared. They'd brought metal detectors and pans with them, hoping to strike it big. But out of the three, Graham was the only one who came home. And it's on Graham's door that Beck is about to knock.
I'd really like to just sort of have a knock on the door and find out if he's willing to speak to us on the record.
Trigger here. We haven't talked much about Graham. Ray, Jenny and Graham all worked together at the Cloudbreak mine site, and he says they became friends back in 2010. Graham actually visited Jenny and Ray a couple of times at their farm in Beverley, where he taught them how to prospect for gold and how to abseil.
What was your impression of him when you met him?
Ash's stepsister Britt met Graham on at least one occasion when he visited the farm.
He just seemed like a super shy guy, like very quiet, didn't eat dinner with us, kind of left without saying anything to anybody. But I didn't think anything bad about him. I just thought he was a bit quiet and wanted to keep to himself. Not someone I'd want as a friend.
Graham only ever gave one interview to the media a few months after Ray and Jenny disappeared, but he did cooperate with the police. He provided at least four voluntary statements, agreed to numerous searches of his home and car, and took part in two recorded police interviews. However, he didn't attend Ray's funeral. We've been hunting around for information about Graham. There's not a lot out there, but we did find this old Channel 9 news report from the early 2000s. In it, Graham's receiving a bravery award for fighting off three attackers who broke into his home.
Graham was set upon after he caught the trio in a child's bedroom as his family slept. He was beaten with a baseball bat and an axe 15 times, but the keen martial arts exponent managed to fight back.
You haven't got time to think. If you think about it, you're too late.
When the Kelletts were reported missing, Graham was called for information. Graham actually travelled back to the campsite to help police at their request with the search. He took officers southeast of the camp to an area he said the trio had dubbed the $3 million patch, where he said they had planned to go prospecting. This, it turns out, was nowhere near where Ray's body was ultimately found, which was actually to the north of the campsite. Graham later explained he misunderstood what the police were asking of him, and police had already searched other areas. Forensics officers examined Graham's belongings, including his car and trailer, and took samples. But he wasn't a suspect.
Yeah, in fact, in the early stages, police weren't convinced there was foul play. And if there's no foul play, there's no suspect.
Police say they have no evidence of third-party involvement in the disappearances.
But some sections of the media were beginning to ask Graham some tough questions.
What condition were they in when you left them?
No comment. Adama Road, please.
Well, what did they say to you?
Adama Road.
Can you begin to explain what's happened here? What do you think?
I don't know. I've run through all sorts of different scenarios, possibilities, and nothing makes sense. Just nothing makes sense at all.
Nothing was making sense to police either. And as time went by and Jenny still wasn't found, the narrative within Major Crime began to shift. In October, 6 months after Ray and Jenny's disappearance, police announced they were looking to rule out foul play. Graham was brought in for an interview in November, which lasted for 12 hours. His home was extensively searched. The next day, he was released without charge. Then things went quiet for a bit. That is, until an inquest was held into the Kelletts' deaths, almost 5 years after their disappearance.
Family members of Ray and Jenny Kellett packed the Perth Coroner's Court for the first day of the two-week inquest.
Graham Milne was back in the spotlight. A senior police officer who reviewed the case took the stand and dropped a bombshell.
Homicide detective Stephen Cleal testified some of Mr. Milne's statements to police were not supported by the evidence. Sergeant Cleal testified that other persons of interest had all been eliminated, with the exception of Graham Milne, who remains a suspect.
It's important to say Graham has always strenuously denied having anything to do with his friends' deaths.
But it's also true to say that when he took the stand, some of the details of his story were a little strange. According to Graham, he, Ray and Jenny camped together over 4 days. He said on the first day of the trip, he and Ray spotted two men firing guns, and Graham wanted to warn them that they were nearby. So he says he put a cigarette packet in the fork of a tree, and Ray took 2 shots at it, hitting it on the second go.
And then there was this testimony about his marathon prospecting trip. Graham told the inquest he decided to leave Ray and Jenny behind and go prospecting on his own. This trip lasted between 18 and 20 hours. 18 to 20 hours alone with a metal detector seems like a long time. At that time of the year, it's really hot out and dehydration is a real risk. So what prompted Graham to take off on his own? Well, Graham said it all had to do with Ella. Who's Ella? She's Ray and Jenny's dog, a rescue Great Dane who accompanied them on the trip. By all accounts, Ella was a bit of a giant lap dog and very good-natured.
Ellie? Annie woo? Anyone who doesn't want a picture taken?
This is a home video of Jenny teasing Ella. According to Graham, Ella kept chasing wildlife and interrupting their attempts at prospecting. But for the family, this doesn't make any sense. Here's Jenny's daughter, Britt.
She was always very well behaved with me. You know, she maybe chased a kangaroo once, no further than eyesight, and then would come straight back.
Annoyed at Ella, Graham left Ray and Jenny behind and embarked on his 20-hour prospecting trip. And that was the last time he says he saw them. When Graham returned to camp, it was dark, sometime between 2 and 3 in the morning. And assuming the Kelletts were asleep, Graham says he left without saying goodbye.
What happened next is a little odd as well. The story of Graham's return journey to Perth didn't add up. You see, there are a couple of roads you can take to get from the campsite to Perth. One is gravel, the other is sealed. Graham told police he took the sealed road, not the gravel road, when he left the campsite. But his GPS data told a different story. When police confronted Graham with this, he admitted that he lied. This is what Graham then said actually happened. So follow me here because it can get confusing. Graham said he took the sealed road heading towards Perth. But then he says he changed his mind and turned the car around to drive back to Jenny and Ray. And then changed his mind again and drove back to Perth. Part of Graham's police interview was later read out in the coroner's court. We've revoiced his testimony.
Okay, I lied about the GPS, but it's actually a fact that I'd gone off and I'd gone up that road. I'm a dickhead for trying to pull the wool over your eyes, so to speak. I came down the Mount Magnet Road and I went back up the road. I was going to go back to camp. I don't know why. I was thinking at the time why I'd done it. That's why I stopped. I stopped for about 15 odd minutes, turned around and came home.
Graham was also questioned about his statement during the inquest.
Why were you on the Payne's Find Sandstone Road about 5 kilometres up the shortcut that morning?
Because I was actually going back to camping.
Why?
Well, I thought about it and I thought, well, might as well stick with them. And I got partway up there, 5 clicks, stopped, thought about it, and I was actually supposed to go to work. Then I knew if I hadn't gone in, the crew would have been short. So I turned around and headed home. I changed my mind. I was going to go back and I was going to ring them and tell them I wasn't coming in. And then I suppose a conscience got the better of me and I stopped, thought about it, and then decided, no, I will go back to work.
Mr. Milne, if that was your explanation, why didn't you provide that to police when they interviewed you in 2015?
Because it made me out to be an idiot. It was embarrassing.
Finally, there were also questions raised about the presence of Graham's DNA. 3 cigarette butts were found near the mineshaft where Ray's body was found. It took the police a month to collect and test them, but when they did, it turns out 2 of them had Jenny's DNA on them, and the third, well, that had Graham's. Graham told the coroner's court he never stopped at this mineshaft, and he certainly never had a smoke with Jenny there.
Mr. Milne, are you able to explain why your DNA was found on a cigarette butt in proximity to a cigarette butt with Jenny's DNA profile found on it?
Dunno.
Can you offer an explanation for why those cigarette butts were found within proximity of each other near the mine shaft in the photo I showed you a short time ago?
I don't know.
Graham's lawyer did propose a theory that during the police search, the cigarette butts could have gotten lodged in the tread of someone's boots and were deposited there by chance. The coroner says this was improbable. And there was another item, a disposable water bottle found down the mineshaft next to Ray's body. It had Graham's, Jenny's and Ray's DNA on it.
Are you able to provide any explanation as to why your DNA would be, might have been detected, or at least the profile matching your DNA might have been detected on this water bottle?
Yes, because Jen filled those water bottles, the pump pots, pump bottles, or whatever they refer to them as, prior to going out anywhere, and they were recycled.
So your evidence is that you shared water bottles?
Well, they were washed, but yeah.
Are you able to proffer any explanation as to why that water bottle was at the bottom of the mine shaft with Ray Kellett's remains?
Dunno.
When the inquiry concluded, the coroner decided the case should be referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions. She also concluded that Ray had died from homicide by persons unknown. She cautioned against the public making assumptions about Graham's involvement in the couple's deaths. Beck and I still wanted to talk to Graham, but he's never really spoken to the media about the Kelletts beyond that one interview he did with Channel 7 back in 2015. And I wonder if that's because he feels he can't trust anyone to tell his side of the story. So we tried reaching out to him, but we weren't having any luck. Then, a bit of a breakthrough. I was sent screenshots of some recent Facebook posts from someone who knew Graham well. So I had these screenshots sent to me. Got my interview with detectives tomorrow regarding information I have regarding the Kellett murder. I am so prepared to not sleep tonight and expect to level up every single gun on COD. I'm a hot mess at the moment.
What's COD? Is it some kind of computer game?
Yeah, wait, we can do this.
Yeah, no, I know what it is. It's
Call of Duty.
Call of Duty.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, what's the other one?
Okay, another one. All done. I'm not in any way what people should consider okay, but I strangely am comfortable with this current version of okay. Give it a few days and some facts, truth I learned today will probably destroy me. We give him a call and he agrees to meet with us.
At the roundabout, take the first exit onto Route 66.
Where are we going?
Yes, we are in the car, if you couldn't tell. We're going to Rob Jabot's house.
Rob Jabot is Graham's stepson. Although Rob doesn't like to be described that way. The pair really don't get on.
All right, this looks like it. I guess I'm just gonna park in the driveway because there's really no other space. We'll ask him. All right, we're here. No worries. I've parked you in. Is that okay?
No, that's not my car.
Oh, but is that okay if we have a
car?
Yeah.
No, we sit down at Rob's dining room table. He's never been interviewed before.
Yeah, cool. Let's do this.
Might be able to fit in there.
Yeah.
Rob's a single dad, and there's kids' toys scattered around the lounge room. He's in his late 30s, and he's wearing a black hoodie with a skull on the front and black-rimmed glasses. He tells us he's a big true crime buff.
I like the dirty facts of true crime and I will sit there for ages watching interrogations and whatnot.
Rob says Graham has always been a solitary guy.
He's a real sort of hermit-y type person. So before everything, he was just him, Graham. Though after this had happened, it didn't seem that he had changed. Kept to himself, very sort of self-proud sort of person. He did seem, with the amount of police and media and stuff, it did sort of aged him, is the only... he suddenly looked like he was starting to look older.
He says that after Ray and Jenny's disappearance, Graham and his partner, that's Rob's mum, Michelle, became more withdrawn.
We noticed even when we were living a house away, neither of them would come visit us. It was always having to go there. So it was sort of while it's all going on, they both went into sort of lockdown into the house, but everyone else around just went on as if life went on.
Rob's now estranged from both Graham and Michelle. He says he hasn't spoken to either of them in more than 5 years. But they were on better terms back in 2015. And when Ray and Jenny went missing, his mum reached out to fill him in, mostly via text messages. Turns out, Rob still has them.
I got a message from my mum saying, do you know those prospectors that went missing? They were Graham's friends. He was the last person with them.
The police called Graham and said they have ruled out homicide with Ray. They also told him when he lands back in Perth not to have his name on his work shirt. This has broken Graham. I feel so sorry for him. He's called me crying again tonight and everyone is avoiding talking to him. It's like he's told them he has cancer. Graham is so devastated, it's not funny. I'm so worried. Made him call the work chaplain, Don, who has been calling him every couple of days.
Reading those texts, I can't help but feel a little uneasy. They tell a side of the story I haven't heard before. Graham's. It's uncomfortable, but I want to hear them all. Rob shows me one, written only a few months after the Kelletts went missing.
And this is her message. So me being me, decided to do a shitload more brainstorming with Graham. Surprised he is still talking to me. Anyway, the 5 hours that is missing from his timeline, I think I found it. And it was between Graham leaving camp and fueling up. The cops and Graham didn't know the time and it didn't show on the statement. So I called the bank and got the time. And now the timeline GPS data fit. All but about half an hour.
Hang on. The 5 hours missing from his timeline. If this message was sent in June 2015, just 2 months after Ray and Jenny's disappearance, does that mean police knew Graham's GPS data contradicted his version of events way back then?
Yeah, and if that's the case, why did it take a further 3 months to consider the idea that Ray's death may have been a homicide? Both sides of the family are unhappy with the way the early investigation was handled by police. My stepsister, Jenny's daughter Brittany, worries evidence may have been missed.
I have very strong feelings that it was absolutely just shambles from the beginning.
Ray's daughters flagged their concerns from day one, but Mel and Charmaine feel they were ignored by police.
Dad and lost out in the bush in the same sentence, like, it just doesn't comprehend in our family.
No.
No.
Not long after speaking with Rob, I get a text message from Britt. It says, I found it. She's also sent me a photo. In it, she's holding a large black cap thing in her hand. I'm not good with guns, so it takes me a moment to realise it's a picture of a shotgun shell. It's the one she found in her mum's car after police packed up the couple's belongings a few days after they were reported missing. You might remember her talking about it from our last episode. She thought she'd chucked it out.
I found like an empty shotgun shell. They didn't take that. They said it was worthless. It was nothing. So I threw it in the bin.
But there it was all along. Would the police be interested in looking at this now? It seems like crazy good luck more than anything that Britt didn't follow the advice of the early investigators. Police wouldn't talk to us about the shell or anything else about the case. So we found someone who could. Someone with inside knowledge of the investigation at the time.
Dr. Mark Reynolds is a towering giant of a man. He has an authoritative baritone when he speaks about his 3 decades working for the WA police, both in uniform and as a forensics expert. Back in 2015, Mark was a forensic science consultant and the manager of quality assurance for WA police. And it was in this capacity that he reviewed the Kellett's case.
It was my job to make sure that whatever forensic work came out of the WA police, it was grounded on good science.
When Ash mentions Britt's shotgun shell to Dr. Reynolds, he looks genuinely surprised.
She found a shotgun casing in the car and they just told her to chuck it in the bin. And she's recently just found it. Last night she sent me a text message, a photo of the shotgun casing. Did I just blow your mind?
They told her to throw it in the bin.
Yeah, that's what she
and
was
And it came
told.
Out of the belongings packed up at the camp.
Yes.
I'm flabbergasted. That's the first I've heard of it too, by the way.
He's not someone who should be easy to shock, but Ash seems to have managed it.
There's a photo of it. She found it last night. She was actually looking for a photo of her mum and it was in this sort of trove of belongings she had from their campsite. Should she be handing that in?
Say again?
Should she be going and handing that in to the coppers now? Would that hold any significance now?
Absolutely, it still would. And whoever told her to throw it in the bin needs to be retrained. In fact, I don't know what to say. unfortunately, another criticism of the handling of this by the WA police.
Back when Mark was working on the Kellett case, he began to have concerns about the direction it was taking.
In my head, there's your first clue. It's missing people. There's two. So what's ever happened to them, you've got to think, well, it's happened to two people at the same time, and that's very strange.
He wanted it treated as a homicide investigation.
When you start looking at the various factors collectively together, then for me, there was just too much for me to not raise it. You know, the blood on the boots, both on the top and the bottom, you know, the DNA results from the cigarette butts, all sorts of things.
Blood was found deep inside the tread of Ray's boots and a single drop of blood on top of his boot, which had landed from directly above. Mark gave evidence to the coronial inquest that this could mean Ray's injuries caused significant bloodletting, and he believed Ray had stood in a pool of his own blood before he was incapacitated.
The holos of it all, you know, becomes greater than the sum of the parts. And if you look at each part individually, then quite often red flags or bells, you know, don't ring. The hairs on the back of your neck don't go up, that sort of stuff. That's when I think experience and common sense comes into play, and it gets to the point where you just got to say, look, enough's enough. You know, what do you need before you realise that this potentially is a double homicide?
Mark says he wrote a report to his superiors in the WA Police Forensics Division, airing his concerns in July 2015. But he says it went down like a lead balloon.
And how was that report received?
Let me just say, culturally within the police service, they don't like things going to paper because it becomes harder to deal with. And so, no, it wasn't received favourably, but I didn't care.
Why do you think the investigation didn't start off as a homicide investigation?
Where the offence or where the incident occurred is out in the middle of nowhere. So straight away, anybody that's going to say, hey, we're unhappy with this, we think there's circumstances of criminality and we're going to call this for a homicide or a double homicide, they're going to spend a significant amount of money and there will be significant pressure, and I don't care what anybody says, there will be significant pressure on them to be damn sure.
In your experience, is this often the case with crimes that happened in remote areas? Is it harder to sort of, I guess, ramp up and get the resources out there?
I wouldn't say that it's systemic to regional Western Australia. But what I would say, it's just very difficult to provide a metropolitan area response to a regional area in far north West Australia, for example.
The landscape up there can feel intimidating. It's hot and bright and, to a couple of city slickers, can almost feel like you're on another planet. Was the bush just so rugged that it became the primary suspect? And then, once it was declared a missing persons case, maybe it just got really hard to change course. Mark tells us sometimes the culture within the force can get in the way of an investigation.
Detectives in major crime are not always that receptive to ideas from outside of their office. And so, yeah, it can be challenging. But, look, culture plays a part in the world for everything. Just in the police service, sometimes it can get in the way of things.
In your opinion, were there mistakes made in the early part of the investigation?
I guess it would depend on what your definition of mistake is. And hindsight's always 20/20. But if one of them is your opinion, you know, nobody took it seriously enough soon enough, then I would agree with that.
What Mark's saying about police culture makes us curious about what else was going on inside WA police during this time. And it turns out there was a lot. In 2015, detectives at the Major Crime Branch of WA Police, which was heavily involved in the Kellett investigation, were themselves being investigated by Internal Affairs following the wrongful imprisonment of a young Indigenous man. The then head of Major Crime and a number of other officers were stood aside and forced to relinquish their cases. And this was all happening a couple of months after Ray and Jenny went missing, or in other words, right in the middle of that investigation.
We actually wanted to get WA Police's side of the story on a lot of things, so we emailed them a long list of questions. Why did it seemingly take so long to treat the Kellett's case as a homicide? Did the remote location and the associated costs have anything to do with it? Have police procedures changed since their search was reviewed? And is the family owed an apology? WA Police sent an email back with just two lines.
Thank you for putting your queries in writing. As the investigation is still open and being actively worked on, we are unable to provide any comment.
Just 2 days after we got that very brief statement, the police commissioner announced that the WA government would offer $1 million rewards for 64 unsolved homicides and missing persons cases. Jenny and Ray's case was on that list. And because there are two people involved, if someone comes forward with information that leads to a conviction, their case attracts one of the highest rewards, $2 million.
We heard that WA Police Commissioner Cole Blanche would be on ABC Radio to talk about the new rewards. This could be my chance to ask some questions. So, out the front of the studio, on the side of a busy road, I bail him up.
Commissioner, one of the cases that will be affected by this announcement are the case of Ray and Jenny Kellett. Some of the family members of Ray and Jenny have suggested that was the investigation treated as a homicide from the very start, this reward would not be necessary now. What would you say to that?
Look, that matter, as you know, was part of a coronial inquest and those findings were made, so I'm not going to comment any further on that.
The family have suggested that they may in fact be due an apology because the incident was not treated as a homicide from the very start. Do you have anything to say to that family?
I could never understand what they're feeling, the grief that all of these victims' families go through. These are tragedies in Western Australian history. As I said, the coroner did make recommendations, and the recommendation she made for police was to do a better land search with multiple forward commanders, and that was the outcome of that coronial inquest.
Just on this point raised by the Commissioner, we should say the coroner found the initial search and rescue operations were comprehensive, but she recommended that in future searches, police deploy two search coordinators on the ground instead of one in regional and remote areas.
Do you believe that the case should have been treated as a homicide from the get-go?
Well, look, we always aim to improve our policing practices, and I think over the years you've seen significant improvements in the way we do land searches, the way we investigate crime. Every detail that we apply to evidence over the years has always improved, and my job as Commissioner is to keep that improvement going.
Despite the Commissioner's confidence, it's 8 years on and the police investigation hasn't yielded results. It feels like it's been up to Jenny and Ray's families and people like Rick, the ex-military guy who helped us dig for clues, to try and find missed evidence. They're the ones who make sure Jenny and Ray aren't forgotten.
We're here.
And now I'm here, out the front of a little house in Perth South, doing my bit and hoping to speak to Graham Milne, the last person to see Ray and Jenny alive. Seems only fair we knock on his door to see if he wants to share his side of the story.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, nervous. I have butterflies in my belly. I feel like I'm going to feel heaps better once this is over and done with. Yeah. I let Beck go out alone. It's all a bit much for me and I prefer staying in the car. Suddenly I can hear Graham's voice. It's being picked up by the mic still in my hand. I'm shocked because he's not even known to answer the door when journalists come knocking.
Oh my God, he's speaking to her.
Well, that was interesting. He answered the door. He was pretty reticent. He said he wasn't interested when he heard I was from the media. What would you have liked to ask Graham if he had agreed to talk to us?
Like, I don't know if I had one burning question. You know, maybe one would be, why didn't you attend Ray's funeral? Just hear his side of things. We heard his version of events in the coroner's court, but yeah, just how it's affected him, I guess. Like, those sorts of questions that have never really been asked before. What the hell happened?
Back in the office, we have one last job to do. We've decided to send Graham a letter, telling him about Ash's link to the case and what it would mean to her family if he would agree to talk to them. We go back to his house to put it in the mailbox, and this time, Ash comes to the door.
Low-key
glad that he didn't answer.
Yeah.
I was so scared to go and knock on his door. And it's so stupid. It's so simple. Just knock on his door. Like, it doesn't seem like that big a deal.
I know the letter is a long shot, and I don't really expect a response. But talking to Rick, looking in mine shafts, and speaking to Rob were all long shots. When someone you love goes missing, after so many years without answers, sometimes long shots are all you get. The person who took Ray's life is still out there. And until Jenny's found, her children, Darcy, Kelly, and Britt, are holding on to the hope that one day they'll be able to bring her body home. That she'll be laid to rest with Ray, on their farm, where she belongs.
Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Hamish Camilleri. Fact-checking by Ben Sveen. Our supervising producer is Mario Christodoulou. The executive producer is Fanu Falali. I'm Beck Trigger.
And I'm Ashley Davis. You can subscribe to Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app. Thanks for listening.